talk about this in front of many people. Well, in fact, this is sort of the topic I've been advocating for the last few years, so there may be some people who have heard this several times already. Anyway, you know, this is like a TV commercial. If you hear it several times, I think then you gradually start trusting it. Okay? Anyway, in fact, even if you hear it once, I think I hope you trust in this formalism and use it. Oh, by the way, so in fact, this talk is not quite on physics models. It's rather sort of a tools you I'd like you to use when you analyze all, you know, the models, whatever you like. Anyway, before going into, in fact, the dead-end formalism, I mean, I don't know what kind of meeting is, I mean, this should be, but I thought it was quite informal. And I just want to make some comments on the Paul Steinkamp's talk this morning. So just, where's Paul? I guess maybe there are some people who agree with me and maybe some do not, but anyway, his talk reminded me of, say, some histories, you know, late 80s, that the people talk about the crisis of Big Bang Theory. You know, there are many things which Big Bang Theory cannot explain, of course, including all these horizon flatness, foundation, spectrum, all these things. But people begin to understand that, you know, we don't have to explain everything by Big Bang. And in fact, inflation came to rescue Big Bang, so, and giving the initial conditions for Big Bang universe. And apart from, of course, and again, some unknown or unresolved problems, we sort of trust Big Bang. I mean, you know, nobody here in this room doubts the validity of Big Bang. But of course, after 20 years, now people blame inflation because they cannot explain it. So this is my comment.
String theory is a theory of everything.
Okay. Yes, maybe I should have added one additional line. Anyway, going back to my talk. So my talk will be on this dead end. I'm not quite sure how much I could go through all this, but at least I would like to just explain to you the linear part, so that the most sort of most important part, and if everybody understands it, it's I'm very glad. So please ask me questions if you have any slight sort of doubt about what I'm trying to say. Anyway, so introduction. This is sort of things. I don't think I can. I have anything much to say. This morning, Lyman told us that everything is going well, and maybe too well. And the standard inflation model is perfectly consistent, and which means that the linear perturbation theory seems to be valid. So we seem to know everything, and so why bother? Why bother doing more studies? My studies on theoretical models. Well, this is just one thing. Of course, we are never satisfied by anything. When we think we are satisfied about 90%, we find that the last 10% contains not additional 100%, and then keep going. Anyway, so we heard that there may be several more interesting models. Or this may be related to Paul Steinkamp's talk that maybe inflation is wrong. I don't know. Anyway, the tensor perturbations have not been detected yet. Before things are, for example, tensor perturbations are detected, we should know for sure that what we are predicting is true. I mean, theoretically,
say, given the model. Now, and then we hear that inflation may not be so simple. We may have multi-field models, non-zero-role. Maybe there are contributions from extra dimensions. String cosmology gives us some different models or things like that. And we have heard about the possible non-Gaussianity and so on. And perhaps we will hear about these models maybe tomorrow. I don't know. It's the three big theoretic bouncing models. Maybe not. Too bad. Oh, well. Anyway, so just, you know, let us focus on, well, by the way, all these sort of things, when we predict the perturbation spectrum, say for CMB and say density perturbations or tensor perturbations, at least what we want to know is the spectrum of those, say, curvature perturbations during, say, the radiation dominated stage before the last scattering surface, and where and where the all the scales of interest are well above the horizon scale. So what we actually wanted to know is how to predict the perturbation on those super horizon scales. Of course, there may be some sub horizon scale physics coming in, but the so here I will focus on super horizons. Now, for the moment, let me briefly review the sort of standard cosmological linear perturbation theory. On say a spatially flat background, and the general metric, while just assuming this shift vector to be zero, that the that is related to how you choose the spatial coordinates, which are not quite relevant. I mean, we are only interested in how you choose time in the universe. For simplicity, just put the G0J components equal to zero. Anyway, this is the most general form of the metric, linear perturbation metric. A, it represents the perturbation in so-called the lapse function, or the gives sort of a relation between the proper time along the spatial, the coordinate, perpendicular to the t equal constant hypersurface. And this curly R represents the so-called, this is the most important sort of things for us, we call the curvature perturbation, simply because this is the potential. So it's perhaps in a sort of a more rigorous way, this should be perhaps called the curvature potential perturbation or whatever. Anyway, so it's the Laplacian of this curvature perturbation gives you the spatial curvature of the hypersurface. Anyway, and you have this some of diagonal elements, and in what follows I will focus on this what we call the scalar modes, which is in this case, it can be given in terms of the spatial derivatives of a certain function. You can also include the tensor modes, but this will be hopefully the subdominant components. Anyway, this A and curly R and this E here will in fact come into the linear perturbation level, the perturbation of the expansion or the Hubble parameter. And it's important fact is that apart from this correction, which is correction due to the difference between this time coordinate and proper time along this sort of a orthogonal line, the perturbation in the Hubble constant is given by a total derivative, time derivative. And this is the real basis for this delta n formalism. By the way, I'm not assuming any theory of gravities. If you have a metric theory of gravity, it can be applied to any theory, of course, including Einstein gravity. Now, what I'm talking about is, yes. Now, there are several sort of typical choices of time slicing, which people talk about. The most famous one is the so-called moving slicing, where you choose the slice to be orthogonal to the, say, the energy flow, flux of the matter field. And in the component-wise, it corresponds to T mu I component equals zero. And in the case of single scalar field, this is equivalent to the homogeneous scalar field hypersurface, uniform, yes. And another one, which is closely sort of related to this co-moving slices, uniform density slices, where you assume the density of matter is constant, homogeneous on a time slice. Another thing, sort of similar, but from the geometrical point of view, we can choose the uniform Hubble slicing. This is the slicing where the Hubble parameter expansion rate is constant, and and in fact, that the, by the way, in the numerical relativity people, they talk about the space time not usually in cosmology, so in the asymmetric flat space time, they usually choose the coordinate so-called the maximum slicing, where this expansion is zero, which is very closely related to this uniform Hubble slicing, where in fact the expansion corresponds to this h. And h is constant, is exactly the same as this maximal slicing condition. Anyway, and another thing which is also quite famous, and in fact it's very important for the case of inflation, because when you quantize inflationary, say the inflaton perturbations, usually you go into this flat slicing where you sort of minimize the metric perturbations. In this slicing, you put the curvature, the scalar curvature perturbation of the slice to be zero. And then finally, the sort of most sort of intuitive one, which is sort of for us, is so-called the Newtonian or Schiaffle slicing, where you have the standard sort of notion of Newtonian potential or Newtonian curvature perturbations and so on. And the condition is this. Now, these two sort of matter-based slices. So, in fact, when you are interested in maybe I shouldn't say in this way. Anyway, depending on the problem, of course, you can choose any of slicing. And the important thing is that, by the way, all these slicings define the slice uniquely. That's the most important part. You know, there is no additional gauge degrees of freedom as far as the slicing is concerned. So you can choose any of the slicing, and the transformation between these slicings are unique. And usually, yes. I mean, unless you have very special equation states, maybe there are some singularities between different slicing, but here I talk about sort of general case. So these two are matter-based, and the rest of three are sort of geometrical slices. And depending on the interest of your model or the problems, you can choose any of this. The important point is that no gauge is preferable, I mean, theoretically, to others. It's just your convenience. So you shouldn't sort of argue about which gauge you should take. You can take any choose you want, gauge you want. Okay, but the important point is that you have to fix the gauge just in the electromagnetism. Now, we know the reason why I put these three on top is that these three gauges are known to be equivalent on superposition scales. In fact, the equivalence of these two are relatively easy to understand. The equivalence between the above two and the uniform Hubble slicing is not so trivial. And in fact, in relation between these two, I need to assume that the Einstein equation. So maybe if you assume some other theory of gravity, this equivalence may break down. I'm not quite sure. I have not studied that part yet. But anyway, in general, in a usual case, standard case, or maybe if you have any theory which you can effectively write down the Einstein tensor equals something, then and if you assume the equals something, even if you can lose, say, some geometrical part, could be the if you interpret it as the energy momentum tensor, then everything I have written here applies. Anyway, now let me explain then the most important part of my talk. Maybe after I finish this, maybe people just like to go for a vodka, so I stop. Anyway, so delta informalism. If you define the perturbation, the e-folding number is just the integral of the expansion or Hubble constant along this trajectory orthogonal to the hypersurface from one hypersurface, say T, to some final hypersurface, T final. The important point is that I have to fix this some final hypersurface, which usually I take this to be sometime in the radiation dominated stage where, you know, all the physics are sort of converged, or in fact, that's where we give the initial condition for the Big Bang theory, okay? And the T can be any time. It can be sometime during inflation. Maybe it can be sometime pre-Big Bang time, or ecliptic, or a few cycles before. I don't care. But I have to assume that the geometry is regular everywhere along this trajectory. Now, and then you just take the subtract the background value. Then, of course, as I said, I mean, apart from this sort of the correction, yes, you remember that the correction to the proper time. So, in fact, these two cancel each other if you integrate out. You're left with the total integral. Which means this difference of e-folding number from the background value depends only on the final, the quantity on the final hypersurface and the quantity on the initial hypersurface. So it's just initial and final, nothing in between. You don't have to worry about anything in between. It just depends on initial and final time. And this is sort of a picture I'm just drawing and just for something to visualize things. Now, as you can see, you have this Laplacian acting on this sort of anisotropic part of the metric. And if you sort of go onto this so-called superhorizon scale, again, since everything depends only on initial and final, your scale, you know, like in this cyclic, you know, bouncing universe or whatever, your scale may go into the scales below the horizon scale once and come out, or you know, you can do anything you want. But as long as initial and final time slice are on scales greater than horizon, this is this is only the sort of order k square the k, I mean the wave number correction, so it vanishes on the sufficiently large scales, on super horizon scales. So one example is that if you choose both of the initial and final, we don't have to worry about anything in between, because this depends only on the choice of initial and final slices. And if you take the initial and final slice to be sort of a flat slicing, then essentially you don't have any equal number perturbations. But of course, then it's nothing is very interesting. So you, this is kind of an example where this, well, maybe not a good example, but anyway, the important thing is that so this equal number depends only on the choice of initial and final slices, and you can choose those slices so that this delta n is zero. But of course, that's what I'm trying to say is it's not what we are interested in. But the another choice, which is really interesting, is that take the initial slice to be the flat slice where the curvature perturbation on that slice is zero, and the final to be comoving, or maybe, well, it is uniform density slice, or in the case of Einstein gravity, can be the uniform Hubble slicing. But in any case, choose final to be this. Then, well, the difference between these two is essentially, since we took the initial to be zero, the initial curvature perturbation to be zero, the delta n is just equal to the final, the curvature perturbation on the final comoving slice. And in fact, this is the quantity which you are interested in, because we know, say, if we are in the radiation dominant stage, then this is the quantity, well, assuming we have the only adiabatic perturbations, that's the quantity which is conserved and which gives rise to the initial conditions for the CND or density perturbations in the universe and everything. So so this is what we want to know. Oh, by the way, so this is essentially equivalent to the so-called zeta variable, which is used in the literature. Anyway, important thing is, of course, if you just assume the initial size or initial size to be flat, well, you know, this T doesn't appear anywhere. In that sense, this is time independent by definition. Well, it's clear because now everything depends only on the final curvature perturbation. So tricky, but this is how it works. So if you want to know the curvature, final curvature perturbation, the only thing you have to do is to calculate the delta n. Delta n is the difference in the equal number between two, say, trajectories, one, say, the background, and one, in the initial slice, the important point is just the initial slice to be chosen to be flat. But by the way, in the case of the inflation, as I said, this is exactly what we need, because we know, you know, we should, at least, I mean, it's the easiest way to quantize scale field is to choose the flat slice, because that's where the fluctuations in the metric is minimized, and you have well sort of defined quadratic action for the scalar field perturbations. So this is exactly what we want to know. Now, yes. That's right. Yes, in fact, you know, sometimes I put F here, and sometimes I put I think, I mean, to choose the final slice to be comoving is essential in this formalism, so I don't think I should put any C or anything, but the initial slice to be flat is essential. So yes, but perhaps I should put F here, right? Or F and C, I don't know, yes. Yeah. Just writing delta n doesn't mean much in that sense. Yes. So. But in my sort of a transparency here, when I after this one. When I write delta n, it means the delta n from initial flat slice to final comoving slice. This is very important. Yes. Okay. Now, so, you know, to, of course, this applies to everything, but to so get sort of a, the rough idea of how you calculate, let me just go back to the standard sort of a single slower inflation where, in fact, the equation becomes relatively trivial, but in any case, let me explain. Well, in this case, single field slower inflation case, we know, in fact, that this curvature perturbation becomes constant as soon as it goes out of the horizon during the inflation, and it stays constant until it re-enters the horizon again. So this means if you go back to this delta n formalism, in fact, if you take the initial time to this initial sort of a horizon crossing time during inflation, then the delta n between the horizon crossing time, this is the flat slicing where you evaluate the quantum fluctuation. And then this is the, somewhere around here in during radiation dominated stage is the time when you want to know the final curvature perturbation, okay? And we know that, in fact, that this is, because this is constant, equal to the curvature perturbation at rising crossing. Now, then, if you consider the coordinate transformation or slice transformation from the flat slicing to comoving slicing, and then for each sort of a point of space, you have some delta t, and which is related to delta n between these two surfaces. In fact, as it is clear, because curvature perturbation is constant, then if you take the initial slice to be comoving, I mean, initial comoving and the final comoving has the same curvature perturbation, so delta n should be zero, which means that this delta n is, in fact, equal to the delta n between the flat slicing and comoving slicing at initial time. Okay, right? I mean, because it's a bit complicated again. You see, as I said, you're just taking initial and final difference between these two. And if you take both of the slices to be comoving, then we know that this is constant, then of course it gives you zero, right? So the difference, the non-trivial delta n, which arises in this sort of single field case, simply comes from the difference between the comoving slice and flat slicing in the beginning, during inflation. So this is what I wrote here. And now we know that the flat slicing, the coordinate transformation from flat slicing to comoving slicing changes the scalar field to be homogeneous, uniform. So this determines the delta t, and delta t is given by this formula. And so from these two, you get the expression that the final curvature perturbation, which is equal to delta n, and delta n is in fact this h times delta t, and delta t is given by this, and this is given in this way. And then if you remember that Eiffel number, this is not perturbation, but the derivative of the Eiffel number is equal to the HDT. The minus sign is just because that I'm counting the Eiffel number backwards in time, given the final slice. So this gives you this formula. And in fact, this formula is first in the case of the single field or some special case of multi-field case found by Stravinsky a long time ago. And the important point is that now, if you look at this formula, and this delta f is, delta phi should be evaluated on flat slicing, as I said. in which again I said that is the fluctuations you should evaluate when I mean from quantum theory. No, I don't think he said that. No. He was more in that sense a bit ambiguous.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. But you should talk to him. Okay. Well, but the sort of the idea comes from his paper. Anyway, so you see that here the important point is that you can just assume this delta phi f to be simply some fluctuations in the background curve that set equal number. So this means
now the only the knowledge of background equation, background solution n is necessary. Well, of course, I mean this delta f, the amplitude of this delta f you have to evaluate by quantum field theory. But assuming you know that you have to quantize it in the flat slicing, then the fluctuations, the amplitude of fluctuations or phase or whatever you obtain, you assume it as if you just fool yourself that it's just a classical delta phi of a background trajectory. Okay, you are just choosing slightly different trajectory, background trajectory. Which gives rise to different equal number, so slightly different from the, say, the fiducial n, and which just gives you the final curvature perturbation amplitude. Of course, I mean this was sort of a trivial kind of example, but you can easily show that this applies to any multi-component scale field, and the formula would be something like this. The important point, of course, is that the not of course. in this case, if you assume the scalar field to be so multi-component scalar field to be slow rolling, not all the sort of phase of inflation. It's just you need those to be slow rolling when they are horizon crossing. So which means that once you determine say the points in the field space, and if you can calculate the total even number, then that this formula is applicable. Sometimes, of course, this formula cannot be applied to the case when you have some questions. No. some sort of fast rolling, say even before the field crosses the horizon. In that case, not only the scale field value, but also the derivative or the momentum of the scale field comes into the expression. So the expression becomes more complicated. But in any case, yes? Yeah. Sure.
Yes, I don't see where
that ends. Ah, yes, I assume that the final hypersurface. And this the hypersurface I chose during radiation dominant epoch. And on super horizon scale, the curvature perturbation is constant. So that's the final curvature perturbation we want to evaluate. But if it is not constant, if you have some isocurvature perturbations, even at that stage, then you have to wait until it becomes adiabatic. Because this is sort of the important point is this final time to be should be chosen at the time when all the possible trajectories sort of different universes
converges to unique trajectory. Once it converges to unique trajectory, then you can uniquely define the delta n. But if you still have some different sort of universes. Say during radiation dominated, then you have the choice of freedom, right? I mean, for example, you may have some different variant numbers in one universe to the other, then how do you compare the delta n? I mean, there's no way. So you need to have a unique universe. So that's exactly what when we call the adiabatic. Yes. Oh yes, yes, yes. No. What I'm trying to say is that at the final, this TF, yes.
Your universe must be adiabatic at this time. I'm not assuming anything before that. If universe is unique, or if the trajectory, all the trajectory converges to unique adiabatic trajectory during some this time, final time, then it's fine. You can have anything. For example, this applies to all these sort of curvature models, in a way you have sort of intermediate S-curvature dominated sort of a stage and so on. Any or multiple components, yes, like this. So the in fact, if you want to follow the rhythm of the curvature perturbations, then that could vary in time.
But we are not interested in any curvature perturbation around that time because that's sort of unobservable. But we want to observe is this final value, the only thing which we are interested in. Yes. That's right, during inflation.
More generally, delta phi does not become constant on supervised scale. Then you would take delta phi to be time dependent.
No. So even the delta phi becomes time dependent and vary on supervised scales, we don't care. That's the important point. This you just evaluate from quantum fluctuations, and as long as you know how the E-form number changes if you take the initial value, different initial value. I mean, this is just classical, say the background trajectory, not the perturbations. Then you just take the difference between these two trajectories, and then you get final answer. So the important point is that you don't have to solve the perturbation equations. But of course, you need the equivalent information that comes from the information of the classical sort of background trajectories. Okay. Yeah.
Yes. If you include that degrees of freedom you mean here, yes. Because then, what you're saying is that this will become exponential large.
Just before you said that you were assuming that R is constant on supervised scales. But this is an
No. R is constant on supervised scale during the final radiation on the stage. Final means all these sort of amplified perturbations decay into, say, some radiation. And that's before the standard sort of. I mean, for example, take the stage of the nuclear synthesis. And this is the time when we take the time final. And if we know that by the time of nuclear synthesis, all these doses, scale fields of possible things decay away, then that's fine. You see?
Yeah, I think we have to talk about that.
it's a bit confusing,
So I look at, to find an equation, I solve the delta phi perturbation equation, whatever. But what if the equation of state of the background is strongly time varying? How do we define horizon crossing in that form?
In fact, so in that sense, this was the simple case of standard inflation.
Right.
But you can choose any time t, but if you choose, say, some time slice and the flux size at certain epoch, then up to that epoch, you have to solve the perturbation equation. Okay. Yeah. And your standard inflation case, the simplest and most convenient choice is the horizon crossing. But in other models, it may be not so. So in that sense, in that case, you have to choose somewhere, say, outside the horizon, and you have to solve the perturbation equation up to that epoch. And then, yes, right, yeah.
One comment, Justin. In slow roll inflation at rising processing and in a long wavelength limit, that delta psi ends up being equivalent. But if you're not in slow roll or something else, then you have to calculate that at the long wavelength limit because the rising processing is not the same because it's smaller.
Right.
Yeah. So they're equivalent in slow roll, but not
you
are
well at the rising.
Right.
So yes. Right. Anyway, you can just write down this say formula for the perturbations, and which is given in this form from this general delta n formula. There is some sort of recent sort of extension of this to a general slow roll, but anyway, just forget about that and let me go into briefly to the this nonlinear extension and Q. Okay, I think I have 10 more minutes, perhaps. Hopefully. I guess 6 o'clock is time for a podcast, so maybe I should by that.
Should be
5 o'clock. All right. anyway, the previous one was very general. Linear, in fact, in the case of linear polarization, as I said, I didn't use any equations from Einstein gravity. It applies to anything. In the case of nonlinear extension, it's not so clear. I think it can be applied to any gravity, but so far I haven't actually proved this. So in this nonlinear extension, I assume here is the Einstein gravity. Now, again, I consider things on superposition scales, and where now this has been known as sort of a gradient expansion, or in fact, this was. I don't know how the Belinsky et al. Called this, I'm not quite sure of the names for this. The Tomita called it anti Newtonian expansion.
Quasi isotropic,
yes, the expansion. And he called it the anti Newtonian expansion, which, because if you look at the expansion, then it's in fact the inverse of the Newtonian expansion, where instead of sort of gravitational constant is assumed to be small, it's 1 over g, which is assumed to be small. Anyway, and the gradient expansion or spatial gradient expansion was the terminology which was given by this famous Canadian physicist. Anyway, the point is that in this case where you have the say the spatial gradient much, much smaller than, say, time derivative. And time derivative is essentially the controlled by the Hubble parameter or the, say, free-fall time. then, because of causality, when two points are far less separated than the horizon scale, the light on this expansion of light cone is so small that each sort of regions can be regarded as independent. And which means, so no signals can propagate from one region to the other. It's too far away. And which of course means that the field equations, which are usually the equation which governs the propagation of the information, becomes ordinary differential equations. But once it becomes ordinary differential equations, then you immediately see that it's exactly the same as the background Friedmann equation. So that's what you get. This is just some technical expressions we have, that this is the Lux function part, the shift vectors, and some spatial metric, and for convenience, I'm sort of decomposing the spatial metric into the part which is determinant equals to 1, and in fact, this contains the so-called tensor host, times, say, volume part, and the volume part is the sort of a generalization of the scale factor. So, if you want, you can introduce the this fiducial background, say, scale factor, and times plus some fluctuation. But then, of course, fluctuation can be nonlinear. Now, By the way, so this expansion parameter is for epsilon. So if each spatial derivative is condensed, this epsilon. And the sort of only assumption in this metric is that this data can be taken as of order epsilon. And with this assumption, you can just write down the laws of local freedom equation. As I said, the equation becomes ordinary differential equations. So you have the h squared equals the standard expression, and the energy conservation law, which is again the standard. And it's exactly the same. And so by sort of a byproduct of writing this is as long as, well, maybe I should say the classical dynamics on scales greater than horizon is concerned, of course you don't have any backtracing or anything. Everything is local because the information can propagate only at the speed of light. So now from here, you can easily construct a nonlinear Dalton formalism by using the energy conservation equation. You just write down in this form, and then you find that the this was just the energy conservation equation I wrote here. But I'm just writing down the tau in terms of the sort of a coordinate time key. Now, then the equal number is again just this expansion times this was the proper time. So the integral of the expansion is
between,
yes.
So in your last slide.
Yes.
Is it only true if there is no isotherapy perturbation? Because that was the assumption also has a
No. This is valid for any. I'm not assuming any adiabaticity anything.
Well, R remains constant, the character remains constant.
I'm not saying that anything is constant here. I'm just saying that it's locally.
But in the last line, there is no quantification.
Which one?
No, that there is no back reaction to the superposition. Is it only true if there is no isotherapy
perturbation? No. Wait. I'm talking about this. This is nonlinear back reaction.
Sure.
You have in the linear case, of course, you have the coupled system. So you know we don't call it back reaction. It's just a coupling. So if you have that sort of isotherapy, whatever you call it, entropy perturbation, that of course couples to the curvature perturbation. So your
curvature perturbation can vary in time. That is included, but we don't call it back reaction. Here, what I mean is back reaction on nonlinear order. Okay, yes. So the equal number again is just defined by equal number between T1 and T2 is the integral of this expansion, and which is from here, this equation given just by the integral of this, the interpreted matter components, the partial derivative of time derivative of rho divided by rho plus p. And an important point again is that this applies to any commoving, time choice of time slicing. Now, as you can see, If you integrate this, of course, this is total time derivative. So you get on simply the difference between this value of psi. Psi was just the exponent of the this. Oops. Yes, essentially this alpha. Yes. Apart from say some fiducial background expansion. So that corresponds to, say, curvature perturbation in a linear case. Anyway, so difference these two curvature perturbation from the initial final slice corresponds to the perturbation in the equal number between these slices. So this is exactly the same as linear case, except that now this can be applied to any nonlinear perturbations. And you can choose the slice, initial slice to be zero for the flat with quotations. Now, of course, even choosing the psi equals zero doesn't guarantee the space I mean, spatial curvature to be zero, but let's call it flat. Then if you take this to be flat slice, and you take the final slice to be commoving, then you have the nonlinear Debye formalism. That's, I'm just writing down here. And you can have all the, relating to the question you asked, in the case when you have only sort of adiabatic perturbations, then the adiabatic perturbation is sort of specified by the fact that the pressure, or maybe rho plus b in general, is just function rho. Or in the case of scalar field, if you have a single order, first order differential equation. I mean, like in the case of a slow roll, when you have only the, instead of second order equations, if you have the first order equation, then the scalar field itself determines everything, right? And which is exactly similar to the, say, the perfect fluid case, where the density determines everything. Density determines the dynamics, similar to the case of the slow roll. Anyway, in those cases, this can be just written as the total integral with respect to the density, because p is just simply a function of rho. And then you can you find that there is some conservation law. Yes. Right. this is related to, in fact, related to the spatial gradient expansion, where you know when we write down the first expression, for example. So in that sense, this, in some sense, I was a bit cheating. you can have an isotropic universe. In that case, you have the anisotropic contributions here. But the assumption of this spatial gradient expansion is that on substantially large scales, or perhaps not too large, because if you go too large scales, you know, the inflation universe becomes very chaotic. But assuming your region is sufficiently larger than, say, horizon scale, but maybe not too large, then you assume at the lowest order universe is isotropic. It's not on that scale. I mean, you're taking your horizon scale to be small and small. Then on substantially small scales, if you assume the fluctuations is sort of quite smooth, I mean, you can have some nonlinear but smooth, then if you go to small and small scales, you will have a homogeneous universe on locally. So the assumption is that, you know, locally, again, means that it's on the size of Hubble horizon scale, the universe is essentially homogeneous. That's the assumption of this gradient expansion.
So in other words, I mean, where that defines about
the ground before then? Mm-hmm. So this means that this vorticity should not be too large. Yes, it can be of order this epsilon squared, but not too large. So yes. Now, so from here, in because now you have the complete integral of this, you immediately find the conserved quantity by combining these two variables, that the some nonlinear zeta we call is given by this psi plus this integral of b rho over rho plus p, and which is, yeah, well, the right hand side can be evaluated for any time slicing. And the simplest case, for example, is the slice where the density is homogeneous. Then in this case, this part is zero. Then you have this psi equal to the nonlinear curvature perturbation, and which conserves if the perturbation is adiabatic. So this is what I guess I want to say, and perhaps I just finish. Yeah. Yes. I didn't quite get your question. So why? Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, it is. I mean, no. I'm talking that this left-hand side is coordinate, say, the slice independent. You know, you can choose any slice you want on the right-hand side. And the, yes? No. Okay. All right. We can talk over the vodka, okay? But let me just answer to whatever the question. Yes. I mean, it's just simply, you know, if you well, this is a simple equation which I mean we know that from say this linear perturbation that then formalism that once you have some, you know, total sort of an integral, and if everything depends only on initial and final, then things become very sort of a, has a clear. Now, the standard, or the even in this nonlinear case, the delta n formalism depends on the fact this expansion can be written as integral, sort of a so total integral. Not here, the one before. Now, this is the sort of geometrical part. That's why you get very sort of a general delta n formalism, which can apply to any type of matter or any type of perturbations. Now, if you have same property on the right-hand side, if the matter satisfies the adiabatic perturbations, then if you have the sort of complete time derivative on both sides, then you immediately find the conserved quantity, right? So this is how you find it. Yeah, right. Sure, right. That's right, that's right. No. Yes. No. I agree. The point is, but you don't have to write down all those complicated perturbation equations. You know, everything you can calculate from background Friedman equations. That's the point. I mean, you don't have to worry about all these.
No.
Yeah, but the, no. But the, this is no. Wait. This is exactly what we are interested in, you know, during the radiation dominant stage. I mean, in the final radiation dominant stage. So,
I have said some more things to say, but I guess I finished it. So just forget about the final part, and so this is my conclusion.
Well, thank you. Two to come in. So, hey, did you refer to the no. It refers to the beginning of your talk when you said that all gauges are equal.
Yeah.
In principle, of course, but nobody will be describing right now, for instance, the motion of the planet using Ptolemy system. Yeah? So in this sense, okay, like Copernicus and Ptolemy, they are equal. But people who do not want to confuse themselves, okay, should never work, for instance, in the Freudian state. after you get experience, okay, there is the same difference between Ptolemaic system and Copernicus system, okay, between different gauges when you use cosmological perturbation theory. So why you have to make life complicated? And why you have to write equation where left hand side refers to one gauge and right hand side refers to the other gauge? You see as your role.
Yeah, right. But that's how things become simplified when you actually want to calculate something. This was what I wanted to say. I mean, you know, as I said, the only quantity object we are interested in is, well, assuming that our universe is dominated by relativity perturbations. That's the final curvature perturbation on, say, commoving slices. Or, you know, Newtonian slices is fine, but the Newtonian slice has this problem of, sort of, you know, the perturbations not being constant even when the equation state changes. So I just focus on final slice to be commoting slice, but if you want the final slice to be Newtonian slice, you can have it. You can write down the same similar formula, but that's you know, no, that's yeah. Sort of an additional complication in my
sense. No, it's clear. First of all, the quantities are related by simple coordinate transformation.
Right.
Yeah, so you can recalculate it. So why, okay, you wouldn't do for instance for any certain perturbation is the simplest possible way using, okay, this kind of
But then my point again is that as long as you're interested in the final perturbations on sufficiently large scales, super horizon scale, which I guess we do, I mean, only me, then, you know, we don't now have to worry about all this perturbation equation. What we have to do is just simply write down the background equations. That's the information. That's the message. You know, that simplifies things much, right? I mean, maybe you think that writing that maybe for Slava you writing that perturbation equation is much simpler for you than writing that background equations, but not for many people.
No, but okay.
Yeah.
Of course, you can write equation, but after that, you will get nothing actually.
Sure.
If you did.
You have to solve. You have to solve those equations to get the actual number. That's for sure.
So this is
just to give some, you know, some sort of framework, a tool.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sure the debate will get settled in the book.